This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Nearly 2.5 million coastal properties are at risk of chronic flooding by the end of the century. That's according to new analysis by the Union of Concerned Scientists. A current evaluation, all that would equal about $1 trillion in real estate, all lost. Also noteworthy, the total cost of damage caused by Hurricane Harvey last year, $125 billion. And the cumulative cost of the 16 separate weather events in the United States last year, $306 billion, the most ever recorded. The PBS Nova documentary Rise of the Superstorms examines the impact of Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria, which devastated parts of Texas, Florida, and the Caribbean, including Puerto Rico, in the summer of 2017. That program airs on KLRN PBS tomorrow night here in San Antonio at 8 p.m. How do these natural events change people's lives? How prepared are residents in these areas for these hurricane seasons? What is the connection between that and the pumping of carbon into our atmosphere, climate change? And what are ways that sea levels influencing the patterns of flooding throughout the United States? We invite you into our conversation as we talk about the rise of the superstorms and the rise of the sea levels. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at @tprsource. Our guest for the first half hour, we're going to be talking about the rise of the superstorms. In the next half hour, we're going to be talking about the rising sea levels. But let's talk about the documentary, and the producer is with us, Liesl Clark. She's the producer of the new PBS Nova documentary, Rise of the Superstorms, examines the impacts of Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria. And also with us is Hal Needham. He is a Texas-based storm surge specialist. Welcome to The Source, both of y'all. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So, Liesl Clark, you put together this narrative for Nova documentary, and you're looking at the science of climate change and how this is a problem right now. Is that what your mission was with this Nova?
Yes, absolutely. I think when Harvey formed so quickly in the Gulf, all eyes were sort of watching what transpired, and not only did we experience Harvey, but right on the heels of Harvey came Irma, and then on the heels of Irma came Maria. And certainly this was after about 12, 13 years of not having such strong, you know, major hurricanes, which are Category 3 or higher. So not to say that people were caught by surprise. Certainly you can have hurricanes of this strength, and certainly they can come in clusters like this. But 2017 was, you know, the amount of damage that happened, and with sea surface temperatures so warm, I think we saw the perfect conditions for such enormous storms to brew up and make landfall.
So any one of those storms would have been a major story in and of itself, and we would probably be talking about superstorms, but we had three of them, one right after the other. When you looked at the wide satellite view, you could see how they were forming off the coast of Africa, and they were coming across the Atlantic, and they were just sort of just, you know, nothing special. But as soon as they hit that the Texas Gulf, where it was super warm, that was the fuel for that system that created, and they just ramped up incredibly fast, beyond anything people, and so being able to predict where these storms were going and how powerful they were going to be, that was also a new problem for our forecasters. Is that right, Liesl?
Absolutely. And, you know, I can certainly say at the outset, I went down to Houston. I'm here up in the Pacific Northwest, and went down to Houston to start to, document and tell the story of Harvey. And that was before Irma even hit. So we thought that we were doing a story about one storm that was enough to do a Nova about, a one-hour, you know, full-fledged science documentary that would tell us a little more of an in-depth story about where we are in atmospheric sciences in determining and predicting rapidly intensifying storms. That would have been enough to fill an hour. But then, lo and behold, while we were down, we were actually filming in Lumberton, and then Irma comes up on the radar. And pretty much a similar story with regards to a storm intensifying rapidly within a little more than 24 hours for Irma, and then, of course, Maria was within 24 hours, quite similar to Harvey, where people were predicting initially a tropical storm, but then suddenly Harvey went to Category 1, and then, boom, Category 4. And I think that's very hard when you're close to landfall, when you're not so far away from the shoreline. You have a storm that's intensifying so quickly. This is the crux of the issue with all three storms, that the scientists were having difficulty, essentially, in being able to determine exactly how strong those winds would be once it made landfall.
Also interesting, so the hurricane, as it moves across the Gulf, it feeds off the warm temperatures, but it's supposed to be cooling the Gulf as it goes by because it's pulling its heat from there and distributing it through the hurricane system. But because the Gulf is so warm these days, that we're able to develop this train of one severe storm after the next because it didn't cool off the Gulf sufficiently to tap down future monster hurricanes. So Hal Leadham, you're a Texas-based storm surge specialist. What did you think of all these storm surges with these three hurricanes?
Yeah, last year was really just incredible with all these storms and all these impacts. And what was really interesting, as Liesl mentioned, was that these storms were rapidly intensifying as they approached the coast. That makes it really challenging, not only from a atmospheric science forecasting perspective, but also from a perspective on the ground. Texas has done a tremendous job since the 2005 hurricane season with Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. A lot of local communities up through the state government has done a tremendous job developing evacuation plans, preparedness plans. But a lot of those plans are based on, okay, when it's 5 days out, we do this. When it's 4 days out, we do this. When it's 3 days out, we evacuate. Harvey didn't really give us that luxury. It was coming off the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, and really blew up within, say, 48 hours of landfall. So there was a lot of uncertainty, and I think that really played into just the preparedness as well. It's hard to prepare for something that you're not sure is going to happen or is not going to happen.
And so, and we had no idea that it was going to dump that much rain either, Hal.
Yeah, and that was really the big issue, right? As humans, we tend to focus on these category numbers. So hurricanes are given a category number on a scale of 1 to 5. That's called the Saffir-Simpson Hurricane Wind Scale, and that just relates to the wind intensity. And so the higher the number, the stronger the winds. But that really tells us nothing about the storm surge or about the rainfall. And so a lot of people, especially in the Houston-Galveston metro area, and over to Beaumont, Port Arthur, I think they saw the storm track predicted to go closer to Corpus Christi and said, hey, it's going to miss these big population areas in the southeast part of the state. However, even though the storm tracked closer to Corpus Christi, it just stalled out and allowed, you know, the people on the right-hand side of the storm where we're getting those onshore winds just got tremendous amount of rains, 20, 40, 50 inches of rain in many areas.
It's interesting that last year at this time, we thought it looked like we were in for another hurricane season where the hurricanes didn't show up. We got active late in the season in August and September. We don't know if that's going to happen again, but we know that the oceans are warm. There's all sorts of conditions that have to be met in order to create a hurricane cell. If there's wind shear out there, it may not get organized. We may not have them. But once that wind shear disappears, you could get a lot of hurricanes just like we did last year. It's a wait-and-see game, but we have to prepare in the meantime, and it could get really bad. What kind of questions, what observations do you have? Do you want to talk about climate change and the connection? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Last year, during Hurricane Harvey, the rain levels got so intense that, you know, on the color-coded maps that they have on TV to show you how bad it's getting, they had to introduce a new color in order to because a new level of rain was hitting the ground. It was purple. It wasn't a tribute to Prince. This was just, you know, it was just bad. We're talking about the rise of the superstorms, the connection to climate change, the fact that we are dumping so much carbon into the atmosphere, how this is warming the planet, and we are seeing the impact of this climate change now. When people say, well, the climate's always changing, yeah, but never like this, never this quickly, never at this level, and this is a clear and present danger to the continued prosperity of our culture. So what are we going to do about it? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, and Bennett is on the line. And Bennett, welcome to The Source. Sir, you're on the air.
Well, thank you. Number one, you have to recognize that Puerto Rico has been bankrupt for 20 years, and its infrastructure was in a deplorable condition. Didn't take much to destroy it. Second, what you don't mention on your programs is that even though storms have been in the round for a long time and the storms may be getting more severe, none of the municipalities or states are requiring higher quality or higher standards for infrastructure being built, whether it's your one-family house, your office building, or your electric line.
Okay, Bennett, thank you for those points. So the fact that Puerto Rico had bad infrastructure, it's a poor country, a poor part of the United States, I should say. Sorry about that slip. So Liesl Clark, what of that observation?
Well, we flew into Puerto Rico on New Year's Eve. It was exactly 100 days after the Hurricane Maria made landfall, and not much had changed just in terms of recovery. I think Bennett is spot on. I mean, I think this is a territory that was the economy was depressed anyway. So therefore, scientists that we had a chance to meet with there said that people were not prepared. There was Hurricane George, I believe it was 97 or 95 that hit there, and it was devastating for the people, and it took years to recover. Puerto Rico had also just been hit by Irma. And in fact, Puerto Rico, with the limited resources that they had, they were helping other Caribbean islands post Irma, even though they had Irma had just skirted, nearby, didn't actually make landfall on Puerto Rico. The people of Puerto Rico and the government ended up giving up many of their reserves and what they had saved up for hurricane preparedness to other locations after Irma, thinking that, well, that's it, we will help them. And then Maria came, and so therefore they didn't have what they needed in reserves. And I think I can say just by observing what was happening even 100 days later, I mean, we're talking traffic lights were still out and telephone poles still down and huge swaths of the territory still without power. And still today there are people without power. So I think without any form of real aid, and I mean, a
sure, but let me just get to this point. So let me go bring in Hal on this. Hal Needham, he's a storm surge specialist. Hurricane Maria was so intense that even if Puerto Rico had the infrastructure of Houston, it still would have packed a wallop.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, when you're dealing with Category 4 hurricane winds close to Category 5, you're going to have a lot of damage. And the same with Hurricane Harvey. If you're going to dump 40 inches of rain, you're going to have a lot of flooding. But the question comes really, to what extent were these natural disasters and to what extent were they man-made disasters? I would argue that there was some combination of each. I mean, for example, if you look at an air photo of southeast Houston between Houston and Galveston from, say, the 1970s, you see a lot of open farmland and pasture. So if you were dumping 30 inches of rain in that area 30, 40 years ago, a lot of that rain would have just soaked into the ground. Now, if we look at the same area, we see strip malls and parking lots. So this rain just hitting these hard surfaces, we really sprawled out. And so the same rains today would flood a lot more because they're just not soaking in. So I think that really goes for Maria, Irma, and Harvey. They're partly man-made, but partly natural disasters as well.
Okay, back to the phones. John is on the line. John, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. My question is just if the panelists could simply give perhaps a kind of a best guess ideas about the future in terms of severe storms and rain events along the Gulf Coast, say the next 50 years or so, especially regarding the Houston area.
All right, John, thank you for the call. So Hal Needham, can you help us with that?
We're seeing a very disturbing trend in that a lot of these hurricanes and tropical storms are just stalling out. That's what Harvey did last year. In 2016, Louisiana, especially the Baton Rouge area, was just pummeled by 30-plus inches of rain from a storm that just stalled. In 2015, the same thing happened in South Carolina. We're seeing a lot of these storms. It doesn't matter if they're a Category 3 or a Category 1 or what they are. They're just coming and they're stalling, and there is a strong link between that. There's a growing evidence body of evidence that there's a strong link with that to climate change. These storms are stalling. They're dumping copious amounts of rain. That not only affects the coast, but also areas inland, like Houston, or could they even, you know, these tremendous rains get into a place like San Antonio? If storms stall out, the rain can come in hundreds of miles.
Liesl Clark, you're the producer of the PBS documentary Rise of the Superstorms, airs tomorrow on KLRN San Antonio at 8 p.m. You're not in the prediction business, but can you tell me, like, if even if this is just a once every decade type event that we get a Hurricane Harvey hitting the Texas coast, that's still going to be pretty costly and very disruptive to the coastal economy.
Absolutely. And I'm not a scientist, but I've spent a lot of time with scientists in the last 9 months since Harvey hit. And I would say that all of them are saying that, you know, if the conditions are right and they're starting to become more right in terms of warmer sea surface temperatures and the possibility that storms are going to move more slowly, just as Maria did and Harvey did, 2 miles per hour for Maria. And so that meant just catastrophic amounts of rain and wind that affected people even inland, which was something that people weren't expecting to see, that up in the mountains, places, homes, businesses were all just being blown away and were being flooded away because of this slow-moving monster storm.
And rebuilding, you know, we're talking about how to rebuild, and they're being told people who live on the coast need to get insurance. We'll talk more about that in a bit. But let me go back to the callers. This is Greg. Greg, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I do want to just comment that San Antonio, one of the last large cities in the U.S. to do so, is creating a climate action adaptation plan right now, hopefully for a spring vote of the council. And we do have a moral obligation here at home to take significant action. Half of all of our greenhouse gases are from our coal and gas plants, and yet the last real investment we made in renewable energy was under Doyle Beneby. The energy plan being floated right now by our city-owned utility shows us still burning coal in 2042, and we're tacking on these hundreds of thousands of dollars in bonuses for our current CEO, in spite of not having real gains. So there's a moral case, and we can make a difference.
So, Greg, are you calling for a citizen action in San Antonio, demanding that the citizen-owned energy municipality, the CPS Energy, become coal-free?
Absolutely. By 2025, I think if we're going to come, we've put out a declaration we want to meet the goals of Paris, hopefully in the spirit and the social justice angle, but also keeping it well under 2 degrees. We've got to shut down those coal plants by 2025 and follow with gas in 2030.
All right, Greg, thank you for calling in. Hal Needham, you're talking about going coal-free, trying to stop the, how successful would that be? And I mean, the carbon is already in the atmosphere. We've already got climate change happening. We've already got trapping of the hothouse gases. So this is something that we need to be doing in order to keep things from getting worse.
Well, for sure. I mean, there is uncertainty with the science, but what we do know is that
okay. So the level of so when you say that there's uncertainty in the science, the level. So all science has uncertainty, right?
Sure.
In any scientific discussion, you're going to say there's uncertainty.
Sure. So there's uncertainty with the outcomes of the science, what this means. But what we're certain about, we have documented very clear evidence of greenhouse gas levels going back to the 1950s. And there's very little uncertainty with that. We know that we're doing a very dangerous experiment. We're putting out tremendous amount of greenhouse gases. So we know that's happening. And we have laboratory experiments showing that that carbon dioxide, for example, absorbs heat. So we have a lot of these things actually are not uncertain. We have quite a bit of certainty. We see what's happening. It's a dangerous experiment. And again, things like, what really drives climate change are the difference in temperatures between the tropics and the poles. We know with climate change, the poles are warming much more rapidly. So that temperature difference between the equator and the poles is reducing, and that's what's slowing down these storms. And that's the big issue that I see with Hurricane Harvey and these other storms from last year. It's very well tied to climate change.
All right, back to the phones. Kyle. Kyle, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm an avid fisherman along the Gulf Coast. I fish the Laguna Madre and Port Aransas and Rockport. And after Hurricane Harvey came through, I've seen a tremendous increase in activity in some of the game fish, specifically the deep water game fish coming closer inland, even so much as beaching themselves on shore. I'm wondering, what are we doing to document and measure the impact that these superstorms have on the wild ice, and are they connected, or is this the result of just the increase in water temperatures?
Okay, Kyle, thank you for that. That's kind of a very specific thing, but you bring up some great points that we do need to figure out ways to engage the overall citizenry to collect data and tell us what they see out there. But Liesl Clark, is this something that you've heard about?
Well, I can give you a quick anecdote to say that when we were in Puerto Rico, we spent time with a fisherman, and you know, this is his livelihood, and he was very clear that he not only did he lose all his equipment because of the flooding that occurred in his home and his business, but he said that it's affected his business because when he goes out fishing now, he has to go to even further afield, a good 24 hours further, for example, to actually catch the fish that he used to be able to catch closer to land. So my understanding is that it absolutely affects the what's going on underwater. And then, of course, I will defer to Hal, who can tell you about the salinity studies that he's been involved with and also the temperature differentials that happen post-hurricane.
So, Hal?
It was tremendous. Really, right after Hurricane Harvey, Galveston Bay turned completely fresh, down to about 12 feet. I mean, this is usually a brackish or more saltwater environment. It turned completely fresh down to about 12 feet and rapidly cooled as much as maybe 15 degrees or more for several days to a week. So these storms can really change the temperature and really change the salinity over a wide area of the coast.
And the salinity, that impacts, I guess, the fish population. They go elsewhere?
Sure. I mean, you know, fish are used to a certain type of salinity, and we're talking very rapid change, like pretty much all of Galveston Bay turning freshwater for several days, you know, down to a decent depth. So that really can have impact on the environment. However, one caveat, we've always had hurricanes, and they've always, you know, really churned things up, and it is part of the natural process as well.
Right, but we have scientific studies that show a direct connection between the climate change, global warming, and also the increase in intensity in these hurricanes. Liesl Clark?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we've been discussing that the scientists are absolutely agreeing that the increase in intensity is a major concern. And I would like to add that one area where the scientists are all agreeing that we need to do better in our prediction of intensity, one area that has been kind of an unknown for years has been this air-sea interface, which is where the energy from the storm is gotten, and that's right there at the sea surface and into the atmosphere. We're talking right what they call, you know, at the deck, right where, you know, 100 feet above the sea surface, 1,000 feet above the sea surface. Well, no one's ever been able to get instruments into that space where the high winds are and where the energy is being derived from. So now they're flying something called a Coyote, for example, into this space,
which is a drone.
It's an unmanned aircraft, so it's a drone, and they are. It's still, I guess, in its sort of pilot phase, but the hope is to be able to gather data, as much data as possible on temperature, humidity, wind speed, and pressure. And within a storm, they launched one into Maria, and this is very exciting because this is going to enable scientists to be able to tell us a lot more about intensity.
All right, and so that information can be used to try to predict these storms as they become more frequent, more powerful, lasting longer, going deeper into the interior and also up the East Coast, racking up more expense. What does that mean for your tax dollars, rebuilding the economy? I want to thank both of our guests, Liesl Clark, producer of the NOVA documentary, Rise of the Superstorms. That's tomorrow night. And Hal Leadham, he's a Texas-based storm surge specialist. We'll be right back with more climate change talk after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. A new report says climate change is threatening thousands of homes on the Texas Gulf Coast. The Union of Concerned Scientists say rising sea levels will lead to homes being repeatedly flooded just from high tides. The report says within the next 30 years, about 5,000 coastal homes in the Galveston area alone are at risk for chronic inundation from tides. And this would be really bad for tourism towns, which depends on property tax revenue from vacation homes, and even out of, it would really hurt the overall real estate economy in these areas. What questions do you have about sea level rise impacting the Texas coast and up and down? But it's not all the same. Sea level rise varies in different location. They say the ocean is not a bathtub. Why is that? We'll get into the science on that in a little bit. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. We're joined by Jim Gibo. He is the Endowed Chair for Coastal and Marine Geospatial Sciences at the Texas A&M Corpus Christi. And Christina Dahl is the Senior Climate Scientist in the Union of Concerned Scientists Climate and Energy Program. Welcome to The Source, both of y'all. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Dave.
So, Jim, let me ask you, when they say the ocean is not a bathtub when we talk about sea level rise, what do they mean by that?
It's regarding that it's not as simple a matter when you predicting the impacts of sea level rise that you just raise the level of the ocean as if you were sitting in a bathtub and there were no winds or currents, or very importantly, particularly along the Texas coast, the land itself is not going down. And in Texas, we have quite a bit of land subsidence, but it varies along the coast. And that turns out to be quite a large part of the reason that we're seeing coastal areas inundated, not just because the sea levels are rising, but also because the land is subsiding or going down.
So it seems like the issue of sea level rise can be a very local event. Not all the ocean is going up at the same rate all over every coast, and that depends on multiple of different events like you're talking about, different factors. Christina Dahl with the Union of Concerned Scientists, can you talk about the focus on Texas and what you're seeing?
Sure. So we put out a report last week that looked at the effects of sea level rise on coastal real estate all over the country, not just in Texas. And we took into account this fact that sea level isn't rising at the same rate everywhere, so that the projections we have really are locally specific to the Texas coast or to any part of the lower 48. And we specifically looked at what we call chronic inundation or chronic flooding, which is flooding that happens at high tide, even in the absence of storms, and occurs on average every other week. So right now, there aren't a whole lot of places in our country that are experiencing this kind of chronic flooding. But as the base sea level rises, each high tide is a little bit higher, and you start to see this very chronic flooding.
Like we see in South Miami.
Exactly. Yeah, that's sort of one of the poster children of chronic flooding issues.
And so when you say these are sunny day floods, the sun is shining, it's a beautiful day, it just so happens that we have a high tide, and whereas the shoreline used to be over there, now it's over here in my house.
That's right. So often these kinds of high tide flood events today occur during new or full moon periods. That's when our tides are the highest of high tides and the lowest of the low tides. But we know that as sea level rises, those tides are just going to be getting higher.
Some people call those king tides, but that's not really a
exactly.
King tide. A king tide only actually was supposed to happen twice a year, but that's an unusual gravitational event from the tides. But this is with the moon and the sun lining up correctly, and I believe that's what it is. But this is just happening all the time now. Is that right?
Yeah, there are parts of our country like Annapolis, Maryland, and Charleston, South Carolina, where they are already having dozens of these high tide flooding events every year. So basically every new and full moon, they're seeing flooding.
Okay, let's go to the calls. Mario Bravo is on the line. And Mario Bravo, I know you're with the Environmental Defense Fund. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you for having this program. I wanted to call in to discuss methane emissions. We're not going to get climate change under control and be able to meet the Paris Climate Agreement goals without getting methane emissions under control. And that's because methane, which is the same as natural gas, is an extremely potent climate pollutant. It's 84 times as potent as carbon dioxide. in terms of trapping heat. And there was an article in a peer-reviewed article in Science magazine published last week that found that methane emissions are actually 60% higher than what the EPA previously had estimated from the oil and gas industry in the U.S.
Mario Bravo, thank you for that call and bringing that to light. Let me go over to Elizabeth. Elizabeth, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Right. Thank you very much for this program. Thanks to the scientists who are doing their job. I wish we had members of Congress that were doing theirs. I'm concerned about how these very important human survival issues based on solid scientific research is being overclouded, overrun, and outvoiced by the political lobby sponsored by the very oil and gas industries causing these problems. We know the story of Exxon. Ironically, one of the cities that suffered the most was Houston, Texas, which boasts of being the oil capital of the world, and it has billions of dollars in damages, including those to the plant. So this makes no sense. What can we do to support science and to bring the voice forward like this program is doing to override the political oppositions and factual lies that they're putting out?
Okay, Elizabeth, thank you for that call. I don't know if any of our guests can answer that. I think y'all are supposed to be, you know, nonpartisan, not to get involved in politics. But really, it's become a partisan issue. So I guess you just have to vote according to people that support, you know, your point of view on climate change. And let's go to James. And James, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes. 100 years ago, in 1918, carbon dioxide was 0.028% of the atmosphere. 100 years later, in 2018, carbon dioxide is 0.04%.
Okay.
of the atmosphere.
All right, James, thanks for calling in. So it seems like we've got somebody who just... James Gibo with the Coastal and Marine Geospatial Sciences at Texas A&M Corpus Christi. Can you talk about the climate change gases, carbon dioxide?
I work on the other end of climate change, and that those are the climate change impacts.
Right.
So I don't really focus too much on what is causing the changes. I rely on the modeling and the research that's done by atmospheric scientists and others.
Okay, let me try Christina Dahl then.
Yeah.
Christina Dahl, can you respond to that?
Sure. So we know that carbon dioxide, the concentration of carbon dioxide has been increasing in our atmosphere for decades, and that's an extremely well-documented trend. And we know that that has direct consequences for our global temperatures. So one of your earlier callers, Mario Bravo, raised the important point as well of needing to reduce methane emissions in the atmosphere. So, and I think all three callers are kind of highlighting the fact that climate change itself is incredibly complex and a multifaceted problem involving many different greenhouse gases and sources of emissions. And then Elizabeth raised the important point that the solutions and the actions we need to take are also multifaceted and complex. So if this is an issue that you care about or that you're concerned about, we would definitely encourage you to advocate within your community, to be in touch with your elected officials, because there are a lot of vested interests, such as the fossil fuel industry, that have deep pockets. And we need to be able to make our voices heard in order to, so that our voices are not drowned out by those deep-pocketed interests.
So we're seeing, that's not really what, it's like James was talking about, Jim was talking about, you know, he's focused on what is happening right now, the impact of climate change, the impact of the sea level rise. It is happening. We are seeing it. Right, Jim?
Yeah, that's right. We have actually measured a rise in sea level along the Texas coast over the last 50 to 100 years of 1 to 2 feet, depending on where you are. And so that's a very significant change for the Texas coast because of how low-lying and how gentle the gradient is and how our development of the coast has been encroaching more and more.
And so is anyone looking at the economic impact of the loss of that property as sea level continues to rise in the next 30 years? When do the banks and when do I know that Moody's is starting to add a city's climate change plan to their evaluation of their bond ratings. But, you know, when do these things get real when it comes to dollars and cents? I mean, are we seeing an impact there, Christina Dahl?
I think that's a really great question. For the most part, this risk to our coastal property from sea level rise has really been flying under the radar. We see continued interest in living along the coast, in developing along the coast, both on the part of individuals and potential homeowners, and on the part of developers. That said, in the course of our research, we spoke to a really broad range of actors in the real estate sector, from credit ratings agencies to mortgage lenders.
You know, I'm gonna hit pause for you right now. I got to take a break. The number to call in if you got a question or comment, 210-614-8980. I really want to hear about what real estate developers, what banks, what mortgage lenders are talking about when it comes to buying property on the coast, seeing how in 30 years that property could be underwater. The Source continues right after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Accelerating sea level rise in the lower 48 states, primarily driven by climate change, is projected to worsen tidal flooding, putting as many as 311,000 coastal homes with a collective market value of $117 billion today at risk of chronic flooding within the next 30 years, the lifespan of a typical mortgage. That's according to a new report from the Union of Concerned Scientists. And so what does that mean if you are a mortgage lender? Why would you lend to somebody if that property will probably be underwater in the neck before the end of that mortgage? They won't be able to pay off that home. They'll be literally underwater. What will that mean for that homeowner? What will it mean for the real estate economy? It could be a hit like we saw with the mortgage meltdown, but it's one that you can't come back from. Let me go to Christina Dahl. She was talking about this when we went to break. And so what are you hearing out there, Christina Dahl, with the Union of Concerned Scientists?
Sure. So what we're hearing is that there are some initial steps underway by actors in the real estate sector to try to incorporate these risks, but there are barriers to really fully doing so. For example, there's no consistent way within the real estate market to communicate this future risk. And so there's also no consensus on the time frame to consider in that communication. Often the time frame for bond investments, for example, is much shorter, just 3 to 5 years, compared to the time frame in which we'll see significant tipping points, even if those tipping points are 15 years out, which is relatively near term. There's a disconnect in the time frame that timeframes that people are thinking about.
Sure, but when you get a mortgage, you have to go through Fannie and Freddie, which are government agencies. And so this is something that, you know, and when you can't pay off that mortgage and when the real estate home market goes kaput, Fannie and Freddie and the taxpayer have got to pony up. Also, we have the federal flood insurance program, and we know that 12 counties in the United States account for a third of the U.S. flood insurance claims. And these are coastal counties, and one of them, it's Harris County and Galveston County are two of those. And that's a program that's $20 billion in debt, which that not counting the $16 billion that the Congress wrote off on the U.S. flood insurance program in October. So we're talking about billions and billions and trillions of dollars that are involved here, Christina Dahl, but due to political decisions, we're not really seeing those. It's being defrayed among the taxpayers in general. I mean, is that what's happening?
That's right. So essentially, flood insurance is effectively subsidizing coverage for Americans who live along the coast. And so it's creating this system in which we can continue to have risky development because we know that we're getting backstopped by the federal government.
By the taxpayer.
How long that can last, like by the taxpayers, ultimately, you're right. But as you mentioned, the the National Flood Insurance Program has deep economic problems. And so that's a system that we need to be considering reforming in order to have our flood insurance rates accurately reflect the actual risks that we face.
But they say if we didn't, no one is, private insurance is no longer insuring home development in these areas. They're saying, no, we're not going to do it anymore. We're losing too much money. So the federal flood insurance program is stepping in saying, okay, we'll do it. If you can't get flood insurance program, you can't buy a house and you can't build in these areas. So this would be, you know, catastrophic for the economy all along the coast.
Right. And if there were a very rapid shift to that kind of situation where you just simply can't get insurance, that would be a huge shock to our coastal economies. But we do need to start stepping it back gradually so that it's not a shock to the economy, and yet we're moving ourselves in a direction that ultimately reduces our risk.
Let's go back to the phones with David. And David, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I learned to fly back in 1970 in high school, and I used to be able to go up and fly around about 7,000 or 8,000 feet and noticed that when I got up to that, I was in crystal clear blue sky, and I would see the layer of brown haze and smog below me. As a pilot, the kind of airplane I fly can't even go up high enough to get to the level of where you might find that definition of clear blue sky anymore. It's probably, you probably have to ask an airline pilot, it's probably well above 30,000 feet or maybe even higher now. I don't remember being in an airliner recently and haven't been able to see that clear, crystal blue sky anymore. And obviously, air pollution is what we're talking about here, being the driver of climate change. We have so many politicians that still are not, quote, not convinced it's happening.
Right. So David, when were you, so this was in high school, you said that, so I don't want to, you know, you don't have to tell me how old you are, but what year are we talking about? What year?
1970.
Okay.
1970.
So 1970. So, so Christina Dahl, you know, actually the air has gotten a lot cleaner since the 70s.
Yeah, you have to say this isn't my area of expertise, but again, it comes back to needing to ensure that we're properly regulating pollutants and doing what we can to keep our air clean, keep our carbon emissions down, and ensuring that we have a national system for doing that that's very robust.
So there's a difference between particulates in the air, which does cause that noticeable visual effect, and then also the carbon, that's something different. Let's go to Bonnie. And Bonnie, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
And thank you for taking my call.
Okay.
I'm thinking that as individuals, what we can do to combat climate change is to combat the corporate interests that are funding opposition to legislation. We could boycott the products of those corporations that fund candidates that oppose climate change legislation.
All right, Bonnie, thank you for the call. Let me go to Jim Gibbo and talk more about what you're seeing, particularly you're at Texas A&M Corpus Christi. Can you talk about what's happening in that area? Are you seeing, where could I go in Texas to actually see this flooding situation?
You can go just about anywhere along the coast. In a couple of places here in the Corpus Christi Bay area, we have some roads that are being inundated more and more, and the maintenance has increased, as well as people's access to their property has been decreasing. We've actually have seen an increase in frequency of the flooding of some homes and infrastructure already. And that's a really important thing to point out, that this isn't something that's just way off into the future and it's theoretical. We can actually go to places along the Texas coast and show where this has been happening over the last 50 years or so.
So I heard that the town of La Marquette, I believe that's in Galveston County, that they're seeing rising sea levels impacting their lives there?
That would be one location. I'm not specifically familiar with that area, but we also I mentioned infrastructure, roads, that is, and some homes, but also we can see in our coastal marshes the effect of increasing sea level rise and the turning of some areas of marsh into open water habitats because the marsh sedimentation is not able to keep up with the rate of sea level rise. We've also seen that.
So you're seeing where there used to be like the salt marshes now being turned into mud flats because the flooding situation has gotten to a point where the grass that was there can no longer survive.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's a large part of our work down here in Corpus Christi is modeling that impact, that transition as sea level rises.
Are we doing things to try to put a drainage in place, building little ditches or something to try to allow those areas to drain off so that those grasses can continue to do their job of helping mitigate flooding?
Well, one of the key things to do, a most effective thing to do, is to acquire property along the coast to provide a buffer so that these areas that are prone to become wetland areas or inundated are allowed to do so without impacting people's homes or other activities.
Right, because the loss of that habitat is going to be bad for the wildlife, so it's going to be bad for development. Christina Dahl with the Union of Concerned Scientists Climate and Energy Program, it's all about messaging. You know, people, they need to see these messages. They need to know that this is something that is happening, that climate change is not something that's going to be happening generations down the line, but it's happening right now. And why isn't this message getting out?
Well, I think it comes back to the fact that a few things. We love our coasts and we love our coastal communities. These are the places where we've raised our children, where we vacationed year after year. And so when someone mentions a threat like sea level rise, it really cuts to the heart of our identity. So it's a very scary thing to think that the changes that we're talking about are near term, that are things that our children and grandchildren could be experiencing. And yet we need to have our eyes open to these risks and do what we can in the time we have to make these coastal communities places where our children and grandchildren can raise their children and grandchildren.
But we're talking now not generations, not hundreds of years, but decades, and even right now, how climate change and sea level rise is impacting the coast of Texas and up the coast of the United States. And that's going to cost a lot of money in order to deal with, and taxpayers will be footing that bill. I want to thank both of our guests, Jim Gibbo with the Texas A&M Corpus Christi and Christina Dahl with the Union of Concerned Scientists. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.